Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. In this episode, we celebrate Black in Nanotech Week with its co-founder, Olivia Genius. We take a quiz on materials and pop music, and sadly, we lament the loss of an iconic telescope. This podcast is supported by Teledyne Princeton Instruments, which also brings you the Science Off Camera podcast. Here is host Sebastian Remy with more about that program.
Hi, I am Sebastian Remy and I host the podcast Science Off Camera, where I talk with scientists from around the world about their research, their interests, and what drives them.
These 2D materials, I would say they have democratized the materials aspect of doing research.
I did really, really find, I think, what I love in science, which is hands-on experimental physics.
I'm like a kid in a candy store. You can't explain how interesting this is to me.
Join me and subscribe to Science Off Camera on your favorite podcast platform.
Olivia Genius is co-founder of Black in Nanotech Week, which begins on Monday, the 7th of December. It will highlight Black scientists in the field of nanotechnology while inspiring the next generation of nanoscientists. Here is Olivia in conversation with Physics World's Margaret Harris about what sparked her interest in physics and nanotechnology.
Our guest in the podcast this week is Olivia Genius, who's a PhD student in nanotechnology at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and also the co-founder of Black in Nanotech Week, which highlights the contributions that Black scientists make to nanotechnology, and also the barriers they face in being in this field. We'll get on to Black in Nanotech Week in a bit, but first I want to talk to you about how you personally got into this field. I understand that one of your bachelor's degrees was in physics. What sparked your interest there? You know, what drew you into physics?
Yes. So I enjoyed physics in high school. I had a great physics teacher who saw great potential in me and in that field as well. So I decided to take AP physics as well with him and decided that physics was the route for me. So in high school and in college, I knew that I wanted a mixture of science and health and medicine, but I didn't know what the perfect combination was at the time. You know, I was 17 going to college, so I was new to all of that. So I decided to do a physics and a public health double major. And I thought that was the closest combination I could get to what my interest was. So in college, I actually took organic chemistry and I enjoyed it. And from there, I decided, maybe I should go towards chemistry more as a field. So I decided to apply to graduate programs in chemistry. And I told myself if I got into at least one program, I would absolutely go for it. So thankfully, I did get into a few programs in chemistry and I decided to go to Buffalo. I joined my PI's lab from listening to one of his talks where he spoke about nanomedicine and nanotechnology. And he was a physical chemist in that field. And I realized that that was the perfect combination that I was looking for since college, using the material that I'm making in the lab and applying it to the medicinal world and to the health world. So nanotechnology and nanomedicine gave me that opportunity to do so.
That's really great because, I mean, I know nanotechnology, it does combine a lot of different fields. You know, you have material scientists, you have physicists, you have chemists, and then, of course, with the medical applications, you do have medicine as well. So what you talked about making a material in the lab. What sort of work are you doing at the moment?
So currently, I am developing a nanoformulation that's suitable for targeted cancer therapy of hypoxic regions of glioblastoma multiforme. So specifically, my project involves synthesizing hierarchical nanostructure that consists of ultra-small core shell lanthanide-based nanoparticles that are encapsulated with a PLGA chitosan coated that's then surface modified with a hypoxia targeting moiety.
Okay, can you tell me that again in like really plain English, just in case people are not chemists here and listening to this?
So I am developing a drug delivery system that will be able to cross the blood-brain barrier and target hypoxic regions of glioblastoma. So these are regions that have low oxygen level as well as low pH level and are resistant to chemo and radiation therapy. And because of that, the tumors tend to metastasize and invade and relapse as well. So my goal with my research is to bring that oxygen level up so that the chemotherapy can actually kill those tumor cells.
Okay. You talked about the blood-brain barrier, and I know this is a real key focus here for nanotechnology, for nanomedicine. You know, what is that barrier and why is it, what do you have to do to cross it?
So the blood-brain barrier is a barrier between the blood and the brain, I guess.
Okay, yeah, it says in the name.
So it's really hard to actually cross that blood-brain barrier because that's what keeps out pathogens and bacteria from entering the brain. So even beneficial medicine are hard to cross that blood-brain barrier. So with the data that I've obtained, it has suggested that my multifunctional nanoparticle shows an increased crossing in 2D in vitro models. So we did in vitro models to see if my nanoparticles actually give us a good percentage of crossing, and it did show that. So the next step is finding out if it works in vivo with animal studies.
So how did you get into, I mean, you talked about having seen your PI in a seminar. What was it about this particular aspect of nanomedicine that really appealed to you, really, really sort of kind of got your interest?
It was just the way he presented his research was just so, he broke it down so well. So through his laboratory, I was able to actually be mentored by physicists, biologists, and engineer. His lab is multifaceted. And the research projects that he does have a variety interdisciplinary chemistry topics that overlap with medicine. So the overlapping of medicine was what caught my interest. And then as I knew more about the field and as I got more project and understood the field, the creation of nanoparticle and using nanotechnology is really fascinating. So that's what caught my attention when joining the lab.
The one reason I wanted to ask about mentorship there is actually what I did is that, you know, obviously, so there aren't that many Black people in nanotechnology. That's probably partly why you decided to start Black in Nanotech Week, you know, it's just for visibility. Talk me through like kind of your experience of, you know, being, I'm guessing probably a lot of the time, the only Black person in the room, the only person in the lab. What's that been like for you?
Yes. So as I move forward with my career, professional and academic and STEM, I continue to find myself being the only African-American woman in a room filled of bright minds, especially with nanotechnology. I did not know that field existed when I was in college. I didn't discover nanotechnology until my graduate career. And the field itself is evolving so much. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of people who look like me in that field. And so in addition to, you know, my pursuit of academic excellence, I want to pave the way for other women of color who are interested in the scientific field. So as a STEM diversity advocate, my goal is to reduce the cold climate that marginalized groups consistently face in the scientific field.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting to say you didn't know a whole lot about nanotechnology, you didn't know the field exists, because I think you come from a really scientific family. Is that right?
Yes, I do. My parents are both physicians. My brothers have their PhDs in statistics as well as biostatistics. And I'm the one who went more towards the chemistry side of all. Even with, you know, growing up in a very scientific-based family, I don't think my parents or even my brothers knew about the nanotechnology field at the time. if I hadn't gone into it, I don't think it would be as visible as it is now within our family.
You mentioned you've done a lot of mentoring work, trying to help individual Black students and other people of color to learn and succeed in STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or medicine. What are some of the challenges you're seeing when you're doing that mentoring work?
With mentoring, the challenge is that we tend to start with undergrads going to grad school. But my goal is to start young. Representation occurs beyond undergrad and beyond high school. So mentoring elementary school level, because that's where, especially within communities who don't have access or the resources to STEM, these students are not seeing the potential there is or the types of STEM field that are there. Even in high school for myself, I didn't know the different types of scientific fields that were available. You know, I knew the basic chemistry, biology, physics, but there's so much more to that within those fields. Again, with nanotechnology, you can do it in chemistry, you can do it in physics, you can even do it in biology. So you get an overall aspect of what each field can bring and what each field can be applied to using nanotechnology.
It must be really great for those students to see you come into the classroom. And what's their reaction? What kind of questions do they ask you about?
The first reaction is always the best in my opinion, because the first reaction is, wow, my instructor or my, you know, I also do TAing. My TA is a Black woman in a field that, you know, where they don't see themselves in. You know, faculties and staff are never actually look like me or, you know, the students that I mentor. So that representation gives them hope, and they get even more engaged within the subject that they're learning.
And you mentioned this specifically being a Black woman. I understand you're also working on a project called STEM Noir, which is specifically for Black women in scientific fields. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. So STEM Noir is a research conference and a holistic wellness retreat for Black women in STEM. I had the great opportunity to be involved as a planning council for STEM Noir. We realized that we wanted a conference where we can have the open space to talk about our journeys, to talk about our success, our failure, the obstacles that we've been through without feeling like the minority. So we wanted a group where we were the majority and we were comfortable enough to share everything that we've experienced in the scientific field.
I mean, obviously conferences are a bit difficult in the moment. Are you planning to have like virtual events or, sort of online events?
Yes. So this summer, we were actually supposed to have our first inaugural conference, but unfortunately, COVID.
Yeah.
So instead, we did a virtual conference where it was Black Women in STEM Week. So we did a virtual conference, and we do plan on doing more within the next year, if COVID is still, of course, with us.
Okay. You're here to talk to us about Black and Nano Week. What can we expect from Black and Nano Week?
Yes. So we have conference style presentations where our participants would be able to discover the different application of nanotechnology by listening to presentations from faculty members and learn from their research. We will also have Q&A sessions where they'll be able to hear unique perspectives from both academic and the industry fields that our expert and scientists are working in. And as well as they will have the opportunity to hear from universities and college admission representatives of various nanotechnology programs and degree and options that they offer. So they'll be able to hear about the applying process, eligibility, et cetera. And of course, they will be able to, participants who are in the nanotechnology field will be able to share their research with us virtually, of course, and how their research is contributing to advancing the field of nanotechnology.
Okay, and when exactly is that running, and where can people go to find out more about it?
Yes, so Black and Nano Week will be from Monday, December 7th to Saturday, December 12th. Our Saturday event is a self-care event. We know that as scientists, and we tend to not take breaks from our research or from our work. So it is always important to step back and take care of ourselves and our mental health before even being able to move forward with our research. People can get more information by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Black and Nanotech, and also going to our websites, which is blackandnanotechnology.org.
Great. Fantastic. So I'll look forward to those events. And after that week, which I should expect you're going to be really busy as one of the co-organizers of it. After that week, what's the future for you? What is your career plan after you sort of finish your PhD's research?
Yes. So after that week, we plan to expand Black and Nanotechnology. This is not a one thing event. We hope to do multiple conference as we go, of course, virtually if COVID is still with us. But we want to expand and be an organization that actually not only highlights and celebrate Black voices that are in the scientific field, specifically nanotechnology, but also have initiative to be able to recruit at the lower level, which is middle school, elementary school, and have these students get an opportunity to see the scientific field, to see the STEM field.
Fantastic. And for you personally, what are your plans after you finish your PhD?
After finishing my PhD, I hope to be in a lab, still working in the nano field, hopefully in the industry in a pharmaceutical company, and still be able to do cancer research because it definitely touches home. Cancer runs in my family. My dad had cancer and survived. My brother actually also survived cancer. My grandmother also survived cancer. So cancer research will always be dear in my heart. So I would love to keep going in that field.
Well, thank you very much, Olivia. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us here on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we do love a quiz at Physics World. And coming up next, Mateen Durrani will test your knowledge about the myriad connections between materials science and pop music, with some help from our very own materials guru, Tom Miller.
Now, every autumn, the Materials Research Society holds its annual fall meeting. So what better reason is there than to run a quiz about pop songs and bands linked to materials science? Physics World has drawn up 11 quiz questions, and we're going to put them to Tom Miller, one of our hugely knowledgeable materials science publishers here at IP Publishing. Now, I'm hoping Tom's going to do really well because our materials portfolio includes everything from nanotechnology, nanofutures and nanoexpress, to JFISD, 2D materials, Materials Research Express, and flexible and printed electronics. Hi, Tom. No pressure on you then.
Hi, Mateen. Thank you very much. Good to be online with you guys. I'm looking forward to the quiz.
So are you a bit of a quiz nut? I hope you are, because we're going to test your knowledge on these materials questions.
All right. Okay. Well, yeah, I do like a good quiz. Yeah, I like a good challenge. So this will be an interesting one. So I'm looking forward to this.
Okay. So as I said, Tom, they're all songs with a sort of pop songs or bands with a materials theme to it. So I'll get cracky on the first one. So let's see how many you do. There's 11. So question one, Tom.
11 questions. Wow. Okay.
we'll rattle through them. Each one's got multiple choice answers, so you're bound to get at least a quarter right. So question one, Tom. Which of these artists has never had a song with the word diamonds in the title? Was it A, The Beatles, B, David Bowie, C, Paul Simon, or D, Rihanna?
Ooh, good
Without
question.
Without the word diamonds.
Without the word diamonds, I reckon C. Rihanna. I know Beatles and David Bowie definitely have, but I don't know about the last two. So I reckon Rihanna's probably had a song about diamonds. So I reckon C, Paul Simon.
Well, I'm afraid you're wrong there, Tom. Paul Simon had a song called Diamonds on the Soles of His Shoes. In fact, that was a bit of a sneaky trick question because David Bowie had a song called Diamond Dogs in the singular. So that was a bit of a tough one. All right. Question two, Tom. So which metal was the title of the 2011 chart topper by David Guetta, in which the singer, it was Sia, she's an Australian singer, she likens her strength to this material's ability to be bulletproof and stone hard. So was the song called A, chromium, B, platinum, C, titanium, or D, vanadium? Do you even remember that song, Tom?
I have no idea. it's going to be potluck. So I'm going to go with chromium.
Wrong again, Tom. It was titanium, number one hit. So you're currently on naught out of two. All right.
Start as we mean to go on.
Question three. So in Spandau Ballet's cheesy 1983 hit Gold, what attribute of the metal does Tony Hadley use to describe his lover? Is it A, immutable, B, imperishable, C, incorruptible, or D, indestructible?
Well, I know this one, so it's indestructible, D.
That's right, number D. Well done, Tom. I remember that was one of my favourite 80s hits, so you got one out of three so far. Doing all right. So,
fantastic.
Question four. Which of these artists once recorded a song called Made of Stone? Was it Joss Stone, A? Was it B, Sly and the Family Stone, C, the Rolling Stones, or D, the Stone Roses?
Ah, it's a classic 90s, late 80s, 90s. So I reckon it's Stone Roses, D.
Well done, Tom. Two out of four.
Yes.
You're doing well. 50% right. All right, this one's a bit tricky, Tom. Question five. Lady Gaga's name can be spelled out using the symbols of which of the following groups of elements? So was it A, lanthanum, dysprosium, gadolinium, gadolinium? Was it B, lawrencium, dysprosium, gadolinium, gadolinium? Was it C, lanthanum, dysprosium, gallium, gallium? Or was it D, lawrencium, dysprosium, gallium, gallium?
I reckon it's B, L-A-D-Y, lanthanum, dysprosium, and gallium, gallium.
So, yeah, you're right, Tom. Okay, Tom, we're halfway through now. Question six. You've got three out of five so far. So this is going back a bit, this song, before my time. What two materials form the title of a 1965 number one hit by the British band Unit 4 Plus 2? Was it cement and ceramic? Was it B, cement and clay? Was it C, concrete and ceramic? Or was it D, concrete and clay?
Crikey, that's a. I've never heard of the band, and why would anyone want a song called Concrete and Clay? Yeah, that'll do. Concrete and Clay.
Well done. That is correct. 4 out of 6. It's Concrete and Clay. I had to go and listen to that one. It's not bad, actually. It was a number one.
All right. Fantastic.
Number seven. What was the stage name of Marianne Joan Elliott Side? She was the lead singer of influential 1970s punk band X-Ray Specs. So was her stage name A, polymethyl methacrylate? Was it B, polystyrene? C, polythene? Or D, polyvinyl chloride?
I believe it was polystyrene. E.
It was. Well done. Bit of a family, yeah, Tom.
It's that indie kid thing going on, isn't it? Punk indie kid.
Yeah. Well done. All right. Right. You're going to impress me if you know this one, Tom. You know, I'm a bit of a spend my holidays in Germany because my family's over there. And I don't know if you'll know this one, but I'm going to test you. So number eight, German pop star Drafi Deutscher. Mm-hmm. And By the way, his career famously nosedived after he urinated off a balcony. Little well-known fact. It's what people did in the 60s.
Rock and roll, right?
Yeah. He had a hit song in 1965 with which three of the following materials in the title? So this was the English translation of the German song. Okay, was it A, gold, silver, and bronze? Was it B, concrete, cement, and granite? Was it C, marble, stone, and iron? Or was it D, rock, chalk, and clay?
I have no idea. So I'm going to go C. Sounds more interesting.
Wow. Well done, Tom. Marble, stone, and iron. So a sort of German pop song about materials. I think he was comparing the strength of his love to those materials. So that's what
that
was
I about. See. Okay. Marble's quite brittle, but yeah.
No, I don't know. Anyway. All right. Three questions to go. You're doing really well, Tom. 6 out of 8. So question 9. Which one of the following bands with a metal in the title never, as far as we know, existed? Was it A, Tin Machine, B, Steel Pulse, C, Iron Maiden, or D, Brass Monkey?
Iron Maiden obviously exists. I think, but I don't know about the other two, so I'm going to go with the first one, A.
Afraid you're wrong there. Tin Machine was a band that David Bowie set up. It was a bit of a weird, I don't think, just kind of very noisy metal, loud guitars, not my kind of thing. But yeah, the answer was Brass Monkey. I just made that up. The answer to question 9 was D.
It's certainly cold as Brass Monkeys.
All right, this one is question 10, 2 to go. You're on 6 out of 9. So question 10.
Right, okay.
What is the final element at the very end of Tom Lehrer's song, The Elements? I hope you know that song. So it's where he runs through all the elements in the periodic table.
In the sound of a Gilbert and Sullivan tune. I've no idea. You can hum along to it, but you can never follow it words.
So is it A, antimony, B, barium, C, sodium, or D, zirconium?
Run through them again.
So A was antimony, B was barium, C, sodium, or D, zirconium?
Barium.
Wrong. I think it was, well, it was C, sodium. So you 6 out of 10. 60%. So, okay, last question.
All right, okay.
I hope you know this. I had no idea about this until somebody mentioned this to me. So question 11 of the quiz, Tom. And finally, what Queen song written by PhD physicist Brian May, who, of course, did astrophysics at Imperial? It's also the atomic mass of potassium. So he wrote a song which also is the atomic mass of potassium. So was it A, 37, B, 38, C, 39, or D, 40?
I'm trying to remember what the atomic mass of potassium is.
It would help.
Potassium is 40, isn't it?
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I'll go with the last one, 40.
Sorry, Tom, it's 39.
Ah!
I hope so. I hope it's 39. All right, okay. Thanks, Tom. Well, you've got a fairly respectable 6 out of 11, which is over 50%. So
right, okay.
I don't know what that is. I think you've passed the test. Well done, Tom.
Better than just guessing, then, which I probably did for most of these answers. So.
All right, Tom.
All right, thanks, you very much.
Nice to
cheers.
Talk to you.
Thank you. That's great.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm joined again by Margaret Harris. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish.
And unfortunately, we're going to talk about some really bad news from Puerto Rico and the Arecibo Observatory. So what exactly has happened in Puerto Rico, Margaret?
Well, I think we'll find out more about exactly what's happened in the next few days and weeks. But what's happened is that the Arecibo Observatory, which is had been, when it was built, the largest radio telescope in the world and was still the second largest as of, well, this week, has unfortunately collapsed. So it's been destroyed. Back in August, this has been a long time coming, but I think it was also very sudden despite that. So back in August, one of the steel cables that supported the telescope's platform, this is equipment that's sort of suspended above this dish that lies inside a karst depression a natural feature in the landscape. And so back in August, one of these six cables snapped, and it sort of flailed around and tore a hole in the reflector dish as it sort of flailed about. And I think the understanding was that didn't indicate, you know, obviously it shut the telescope, but it didn't indicate any sort of long-term flaw. But then on the 6th of November, one of the four main cables supporting the platform also snapped. And investigations then revealed that some other cables had wire breaks that were showing some signs of failure. And that led the decision back last month in November to decommission the telescope on safety grounds. The writing was already on the wall, I think, but nevertheless, there was a petition to the U.S. government calling for people to take, calling for the government, the National Science Foundation in particular, to take emergency action to stabilize the telescope. And that was signed by almost 60,000 people, which I think just shows the tremendous sort of regard and really love that the scientific community has for this iconic facility. There was a Twitter hashtag, what Arecibo means to me. I think my favorite was, there was a couple who posted their wedding photos that had their wedding photos taken at Arecibo Observatory. And they'd done that because, yeah, they're both astronomers.
Yeah, that was a really nice post. I saw that one. And I think, you know, maybe for listeners who are in the UK, I think, you know, maybe Jodrell Bank would be a comparison. You know, the big radio telescope at Jodrell Bank is definitely an iconic feature in the Cheshire countryside. And, you know, I think a lot of people really love it. You know, when you go past it on the train up to Manchester, from Bristol, you can see it. It's just one of those. I think so. Yeah.
I have to look out for it next time I'm traveling there.
Maybe I was just imagining it, but I'm pretty sure you can catch it, out of the corner of your eye. And Arecibo, I think it played an important role in the film Contact, which was based on a novel by Carl Sagan. And I think at some point in time, Arecibo was even used to send a message to a distant galaxy or stellar system. So it's something that's really caught the imagination of people. And if you look at the news article on the Physics World website, the headline is Arecibo Observatory Destroyed as Metal Platform Collapses onto the Iconic Telescope. You can see what really looks like a lot of damage. You know, we were talking about this earlier. It is a natural depression in the landscape. So I was thinking maybe they could fix this up and get it running again. But when you look at the picture, you can see that the reflector part of the dish has been damaged. It's definitely a disaster.
I think it's really a question of whether there's the money to replace it, because presumably the it doesn't look like the control facilities, the buildings were damaged. And of course, the really unfortunate thing is that nobody seems to have been hurt in the collapse, because the facility had been evacuated as part of the plan to decommission it. But I think the really key thing here actually is apart from its scientific contributions, Arecibo has become a really iconic facility for people in Puerto Rico, which is not an area that has a whole lot of other infrastructure, scientifically speaking. So it's absolutely, you know, really key feature of that territory to have as an outreach mechanism for local kids and students to have a chance to use this world-class facility in what is a very poor part of the U.S., I think is a really sad loss for that aspect of the scientific community, too.
I think people in Puerto Rico have been sort of upset at the U.S. government for a while now because of how the observatory has been maintained, because it was significantly damaged, wasn't it, in a hurricane a few years ago. And am I right in thinking that it was never repaired properly? It wasn't seen as a priority. And I think people in Puerto Rico weren't very pleased with that.
I don't think Puerto Ricans were the only ones who weren't pleased by that. And I think that's one of the things that I'm hoping will come out of the investigation that is surely to follow as to why this telescope was allowed to get into a position where it was able to collapse in a catastrophic fashion. Because, I mean, you know, people can make mistakes in terms of analyzing, sort of the damage was analyzed back in the summer, and I understand that the damage was not thought to be sort of capable of causing this sort of progressive collapse that we've seen, and that was obviously incorrect, but it may have been, you know, sort of honestly incorrect, if you like it. But I guess the question is, you know, why it had gotten to that state in the first place, and I think that's an answer will hopefully come out in the next month.
Yeah. Well, let's hope. I mean, I suppose to a certain extent, Arecibo has been overtaken by sort of a similar telescope in China, I think. Was that, do you think that was a factor in its sort of abandonment?
I think it's conceivable, but I mean, the world's, I'm not one of the people who thinks the world only has scope for the best and most fantastic latest scientific facilities. You know, there's certainly plenty of observers wanting to use radio telescopes and wanting to do science with them. I think the world had room for two, world-class facilities of this type. You're talking about references to the FAST telescope in China, which was commissioned in 2016. And I think if you want to get sort of look at geopolitically here, I think it is kind of, you know, ironic that this iconic facility in the U.S. collapsed on the same day that China put a robotic probe on the moon successfully under the Chang'e 5, I think it was, lander. So, I mean, you could say that it's it was both a sad day and a brilliant day for space exploration and our knowledge of the wider universe. If you look at it from a geopolitical perspective, but obviously, you know, not everybody has a chance to use FAST, not everybody has a chance to use Arecibo. So it depends on your perspective, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And speaking of China, stay tuned to the website later today, or if you're listening after about 7 p.m. on Thursday, because we've got a really, really interesting story from China that I'm going to be putting up then. Thanks, Margaret. Thanks for chatting about Arecibo. It is a very sad week, I think, in Puerto Rico. And if you want to read more about this, just go to the news section of the Physics World website, where you'll find a news article by Michael Banks about the collapse. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast, which is sponsored by Teledyne Princeton Instruments. Thanks to Olivia Genius, Margaret Harris, Tom Miller, and Mateen Durrani for joining me today. And a special thank you to our producer, Callum Jelf. Next week on the Physics World Weekly podcast, we will be revealing our shortlist for the Physics World Breakthrough of the Year. Please tune in for some lively chat about some of the best physics research in 2020. Thanks for listening.
Physics World.